Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60. And I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. All right, I believe this means we're for reals live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy. The SGG of this terribly named podcast series. But the QA, that's the important part. That's the part we care about, because it's the question and the answers, it's the interactive conversation, and it's why we like to kick off our podcast on a Monday. I like starting this off, it gets our week sort of lined up, we're ready to go, and we can also kind of look back on the last week of headlines, maybe some news broke over the weekend, but it gives us an opportunity to really chat this stuff out, as opposed to just always just knee-jerk reacting to headlines in our social media feeds. So, seeing a great crew of names in this chat. Love it. Thanks so much. I definitely appreciate all the feedback, and it's very helpful when you're doing a live stream all by yourself and trying to manage all the production concerns for things like when you have microphone issues. Getting that feedback is vital to the creative process and making sure that we're all having a good time. So, first of all, as we like to start every podcast, as we like to jump in, I see one, Mr. Fat Produce, saying greetings, Earthlings, here in the chat, and I need everyone to tell Andrew to go do something more fun than watch this podcast, because me, Andrew and I, Fat Produce and I, have been, I'd say we've been good friends. We've been good pals for, I don't know, Andrew, how long has it been now? Are we closing in on like almost 10 years of friendship? I mean, I think we're getting pretty close. But we've never met in person. And for the very, very first time in our entire friendship, Andrew took a vacation out here to California, to Los Angeles. And we spent all day yesterday hiking around Malibu Creek Canyon Park. And we completely failed in our mission to hike to the old MASH shooting location. It's everything I can do to not start humming the MASH theme song right now. And I believe this is his last morning in... Oh, Andrew's correcting me. We're not closing in on 10 years. It's more like 9-ish years of friendship. So I'm thank you for the clarification. We got to meet in person for the very, very first time. And it was really a joy, and it just really drove home like the kinds of relationships and the kinds of friendships that you build through these platforms and these services. And someone's like a disembodied username in a forum, or like an icon. You know, this is like a profile picture on Mastodon. And then you realize, like, oh no, this is a person I really have a connection with, and this is a person that has been there for me through some really, really good times and some difficult times. I think we've shared a lot between us, and then it just sort of clicks one day, like, I have never hung out with him face to face, and you know, he met up with me, he got to meet Marie, he got to meet Lex. Lex is like making fun of me, like, wait a minute, you say he's a friend of yours, but you've never met him? Like, oh no, don't make it weird, Lex. Oh, the wisdom of an 8-year-old. Oh gosh. So, yeah, we had a really great day yesterday. I took him to one of my favorite restaurants out here, and we went on that hike, and it was just really lovely. I kind of needed that to just sort of help me kind of move forward too, where I've been kind of cloistering myself off in this office, and I've been an army of one for production and for video and for content, working with other outlets and a gun for hire on other gigs, and then just realizing like I still have enough of that like extrovert flair. I feel like I do better when I occasionally get to see other human beings. So, Andrew, as much as I love seeing you, one, in my time zone in this chat, if this is your last morning in Los Angeles, and especially because the neighborhood that you're in, I really need you to go step out, maybe go get an early lunch at that restaurant I recommended for the area of town that you're currently in. Maybe go see some sites around the studios and stuff like that. I feel like there are better things you could be doing with your time than hanging out with this podcast. You can always catch me on the replay. So don't get too caught up into what's going on here. And Andrew, that was lovely. I was so happy to get to have a blast with you, buddy. It was a great hike. First of all, we completely failed. Like, the bridge was out. We looked at where we could try to cross a stream. It was like, man, if I could jump to that pillar that's just sort of standing in the middle of this creek, I could maybe leap. No, you know what? I think we should just walk back to the parking lot. If my knees were 15 years younger, I probably could have made that leap. But it was a really lovely day. So, like I said, we've got a ton of news to get through. And this has been kind of, Fat Prude is going to head to the Academy Museum today. All right, that's a good day trip. For your last day in Los Angeles, especially because, you know, you're like me, you're kind of a film and film history buff. You're really going to dig that. I just to mention this, we can absolutely talk about this. But we'll kind of save that for post news block. Dagon One is saying, "Hey Juan, have you seen the leaks of the new X100 Ultra with the new 200 megapixel, 85 millimeter periscope telephoto? And it's non cropped tele. I don't know what that means. Unfortunately, no more 50 millimeter tele on Vivo anymore. So we're gonna. That's one I feel we can add. Sony is one of the major announcements just because of all the leaks, but." More information has come out on Vivo and their strategy for an Ultra, so let's absolutely dig into that when we get to sort of more of our gadget block in the second half. I need to knock out a little housekeeping, because this has been a really interesting week for trying to produce content. TK and I talked about this last Thursday, where it's been very difficult to sort of field like all of the announcements that we hit at the beginning of the year, find good momentum, and then just not like crash. We talk a lot in these kinds of podcasts and in these kinds of conversations about things like burnout and the number of channels that have sort of left the scene or aren't producing regularly or have shifted into more of sort of a, you know, sort of a quieter role than really putting out tech commentary. And I think all too often, if a channel has like millions of subscribers, they get this sort of magnified presence because of social media and because of algorithms and platforms. And we imbue them with conversations that really have nothing to do with the tech that we want to talk about. Is this content creator killing products? And you're like, well, no, not as such. And whatever we feel someone's earnest opinions on reviewing a product might be, it definitely seems that YouTube is imbuing them with an outsized representation of tech conversation. It's not through pure meritocracy and hustle and a quality of journalism. It's more, are we looking at channels and platforms that are playing a marketing game and leaning into the algorithm aspects? You know, like we used to game search engine optimization back in the day, all those gurus who would come out and say like, oh, well, to get better search results, you need your robots.txt and you need this and you need to backlink and all this other stuff. And it wasn't really like about the content. It was more, are you satisfying the bias of an audience? And now YouTube seems to be ratcheting that down even harder. So TK and I talked a little bit about that on Thursday, but behind the scenes, like, you know, we're both kind of chatting about, like, what does the future of this look like, and how do we either adapt or manage a transition or look at other styles of content, or do we just leave, right? After a point, are we done smashing our faces against our keyboards? After a point, are you done? Are you exhausted by fielding audio issues on our streaming platform every other week, right? So, that previous mic, they're going to get a nice little clip of the beginning of my show totally borking. It's going to be fun. I think they're really going to like that feedback as I produce a review on their product. So, last week I did not get a lot out public, and I'm debating whether or not I want to make this I'm debating whether I want to host this as a public transition. I've been spending a lot of time just kind of lurking on my own Discord, hanging out on my own Patreon posts and comments. And I realized, like, organically, not through any kind of design, I'm not thinking about this and walking away, but I'm spending almost no time now really fielding questions on social media. And over the last 2 weeks, I've spent very little time engaging in comments on my YouTube videos. If you followed my channel for any length of time, that is a concerning development to me. When I started my YouTube channel, way back in the dark days, the olden days of YouTube, one of the main reasons I approached video was to start conversations. All of my reviews, while I am giving you my opinion on a product, are kind of designed to be conversational, snarky, but approachable, and to not be the last word on a product. I don't conclude the review process, and I viscerally disagree with people who get a product early in the product's life cycle and then act like they've got some kind of definitive answer as to whether or not consumers should buy it. Quick tangent, because I feel like this is a good example of what I'm talking about. So on my desk right now, I'm writing up just like a little script that I may or may not shoot. It might end up just being a written editorial. But the OnePlus 8 and the OnePlus 8 Pro just got their very last software updates. It's on Android 13. It got kind of a refresh update. It was a pretty big update, actually. But lots of bug fixes, patches, security updates. It's now on the February 2024 patch. This is an older phone, right? There's very little organic conversation from traditional tech outlets and the medium-sized to larger YouTubers about what it has really been like to live with this phone. We're now into that end-of-life conversation, and I still feel like this hardware has plenty of life left in it. I picked it up, I installed the updates, I checked out some of just the polish and the changes, you know, little tweaks to the camera app, stuff like that. Snapdragon 865, brilliant main camera sensor. This thing is still a screamer of a phone today. And it still outpaces many of our mid-rangers. Like, if you had invested and lived with this phone, you would not be hurting for compute power. You would not be hurting for camera performance. You would probably today be feeling the pinch on battery degradation over the years, the 4 years it's been since this phone was new. So when I searched for OnePlus 8 Pro, so much of the commentary sort of stopped after that main first push of review devices went out. And many of those, like, I got mine under embargo. So a lot of those reviews were crafted on a software experience that no consumer would ever experience. And a lot of those reviews have this kind of conclusive, like, oh, OnePlus cameras, right? They're always crap. And if you passed on the OnePlus 8 Pro, then you missed something kind of special, because it was a massive turning point in how OnePlus approached photography, and it was a significant uptick. It was a significant improvement over the OnePlus 7 Pro. The OnePlus 7 Pro is the novelty of having that pop-up selfie camera, and it's a brilliant, cool-looking design. The OnePlus 8 Pro is a better phone. It's a better computer. It was a better overall device. It just has a hole cut for the selfie camera as opposed to a pop-up selfie motorized camera sensor thing. So I'm sorry, I'm kind of rambling a bit through all of this, but when I crafted those videos, YouTube was structured in a way where I would put out the video and then it was almost like a forum thread. And you would have engagement and interaction and conversation and debate in the comments of these videos. If you go to YouTube now, either through a browser or through the app, it's like YouTube has gone out of their way to devalue that thread, that conversation. Your comments are a mess now. Getting to the comments is a pain. You have to overcome the apathy of terrible website design and terrible app design and the momentum of just, well, I mean, I was going to, but I have to tap on, but where is the comment? Is there someone who's already left a comment like mine? Are people talking on this video? I don't see any comments. I'm just going to go on and watch the next recommended video from YouTube. YouTube is destroying what made their social media video service social and interactive and collaborative. And it's like, yeah, if you've got a huge channel with millions of followers, you'll see more people making the effort. But all of that interaction and all of that engagement is evaporating. So I realize, like, I myself, because of how YouTube is managing their platform, I myself am not replying to questions and digging into comments and looking for good info. Like, I really did enjoy the process of putting out a video and not spoon feeding every part of the gadget conversation to people, because then someone would bring up some insight or maybe something I missed or legitimately something that I feel is worth examining more granularly, but makes for a boring video. Like if I make a 3-hour video detailing every single tiny little nook and cranny of every settings and menu and option and everything like that, no one watches those. Everyone wants to see you make them, but no one watches them. Your watch time and your watch percentage plummet. Unless you're like a gamer's nexus. But even then, when I look up sort of stats on what we can get information on other YouTube channels, an audience like that, they want to see that you made an hour-long video. They demand that you show your work. But what they want is just the chapter that highlights just the one little part that they're interested in. But they don't reward you with watch time for the entire thing. So I don't know if I want to publish this publicly, but like the only place I want to answer questions now is on my Discord or on my Patreon. Or I mean, like, again, if you hit me up on Mastodon and you have a specific question, then we can chat there too. But increasingly, it's like I have to get notified, get the alert, go to YouTube. See, I've got all these other comments too, because I'm not even getting good notifications on people tagging me in comments on YouTube. Stuff like that. I don't need a notification for every comment I get on YouTube. That would be terrible. But even when it's a specific like, hey, Juan, I'm getting your attention and I am making an effort and I'm reaching out to you, YouTube is even sitting on that. It's so demoralizing because that was like the main crux, the social component. Just like I started this video talking about my buddy Andrew, the social aspect of this is what was so important to me, was what was so critical. And if I have that on Patreon, I'm just going to get that over on Patreon. There are a couple other channels that kind of make a bigger play. They make a lot more noise saying, hey, if you want to ask me questions and get answers to specific things, then subscribe to my Patreon. I'm not sure I want to draw that line in the sand yet. I don't know if that's how I want to handle it. So I'm kind of torn. What's better for my business and what's better for my mental health and what's better for that sort of that yearning, that social dynamic, is probably, I should probably take that step. Just rip off the Band-Aid, say, this is really what it is. But I already kind of sense that, like, the backlash on that for YouTube channels is already starting to grow. And it's also just stomaching the toxicity of how we handle those conversations. And it doesn't really seem like, I mean, outside of a chat like this, where I really do appreciate the people who show up every week, beyond like the people who make the effort to hit these kinds of podcasts and hit the replay crew and listen to the audio stream after it's produced, there's just not a lot of empathy. you know, there's kind of the apathetic shrug of like, oh, well, I guess I'll just watch some other channel. And you're like, okay. I mean, I get it. I'm exhausted too. And I'm kind of tired of how all this stuff is going down. I'm less likely to blame the creators for not wanting to create content when the platforms are so brutal, but you know, that's kind of where we're at. So, this last week, short story incredibly long, that was housekeeping. Short story incredibly long, I did a lot more on Patreon this week just because I felt like the pieces were more appropriate for the Patreon than trying to make public blog posts where also all my search traffic is gone. It's like it's my website traffic has completely died and Google is not pointing search results to even targeted, you know, search keywords, things that I've focused on my blog or editorials that I've written that have always gotten traffic. All of that's vanished. So whenever someone would like to maybe bring up an additional antitrust and maybe a class action lawsuit against Google search, I would absolutely contribute my data to that. The big video that I put out last week was an interview that I'm also going to publish as a standalone audio podcast. So probably Wednesday, an audio cut of this is going to be available on the podcast feed of this podcast channel. Did I overreact to malware on a mini PC? Interview with Shannon Morse, security expert. And my buddy Shannon Snubs was kind enough to join me in a casual conversation talking about what my experiences were with Ace Magic, the steps that I took, and replying to a few of the comments that I got from people who were, overwhelmingly, people seemed to appreciate why I was so anxious about this situation, both for my own personal use and then also for how I talk about products that consumers might want to buy. But I did get a few people who were not skeptical, but I mean, just on the critical edge of, well, you're probably overreacting or that might have been a false positive. You should have mentioned that ClamWinds virus updates, maybe it was just unsigned software and some kind of mistake. And I had two people with three very distinct comments in my DMs, not disagreeing with me, but upset that I wasn't maybe both sides-ing it or being more fair. And one of them, they said up front, like, hey, I've had amazing experiences with these Ace Magic computers. And you know, I even bought one based on a review that you did on an older Ace Magic that I had no issues with malware on. There was nothing to report because there was nothing to report. So I had Shannon on just to kind of talk through some of that. And again, it was like good talk therapy. But throughout that conversation, she gives really good advice on sort of best practices, how to handle your network, how to handle, you know, operating a new computer, putting that new computer on your network, what steps you should take to kind of on-ramp it. You don't just give it full access to all of your stuff. You want to see, is there anything concerning or anything, you know, kind of hinky about that? So I really hope people will catch that video. Of course, it's doing garbage traffic. It's not the kind of sexy, topical, trending topic slamming AI pins and gadgets on YouTube right now. So, of course, there's no audience for good preventative maintenance on a trending issue with a mini PC manufacturer. No one cares about that. You know, your family and friends buy PCs with malware installed on them. Oh, well, there's no reason that would ever be kind of a search interesting topic. Then I also did, like I said, a series of pieces on Patreon. So let me get my screen share back up here. We talked about this on Best of Our Week on Thursday also, but I did write up kind of an editorial look at Apple's quarterly financials. For this week's podcast, we're going to be talking about their potential iPad announcement, but I felt like there was an interesting trend happening with where money and revenue are being generated at Apple right now, as we see sort of a downturn in phone and tablet sales. We know tablets are going to be kind of a big topic over the next couple days, and how dips in hardware revenue are not being made up by increases in services revenue. And I know a lot of people want to be front of mind with Apple and say, well, I mean, it's just really exciting. Look at what they're doing with Apple TV Plus. But Apple TV Plus is also spending so much money on making and procuring content that I don't believe their revenue is a healthy examination of the profitability of their services. More, if we see increases in services profits, I'm pretty sure that's coming from things like ad sales. And of course, when we talk about ads and companies like Google or Microsoft, boy, we hate ads. I can always make a video that'll get a couple thousand views, just like how to turn off the ads in your Windows start bar, Windows 11, keyword Microsoft. But you bring up ads with Apple, and for some reason, that's fine. Like, for some reason, oh, but when Apple does it, it's different. And it's not different. It's exactly the same. It's Apple. They're charging companies money to advertise services in your Apple apps. So again, I wanted to kind of break down just some of my feelings on, or some of those trends that I think we're seeing play out and how Apple's business model is changing. This other one is just a rambling diatribe. I think you guys are all going to be very surprised that I wrote a rambling editorial. I'm usually so concise and so on point. This is a total shock. This is a completely foreign territory for me. This is something I've been working on for a little bit. The title of the article is High-Res Audio, Can You Even Hear the Difference? You're probably missing the point. And from the just sort of the setup on this, on the heels of another friend of mine writing an article about high-res audio, I felt motivated to scribble out an editorial on my experiences with audio gear and seeking out better quality digital audio. This article is honestly kind of a mess and more rambly than I usually try to write. It's a piece I've been re-editing for a while now, though, so I'm going to leave it here in its messy state, and hopefully folks will be able to glean what I'm trying to say as inelegantly as I'm saying it here. And I'm just kind of tired of this tech review trope that if you want an article that kind of confirms a lazy audience bias, every couple of years you can put out a series of like, I did a listening test and I totally couldn't even hear the difference between MP3 and high res. It's all just snake oil. And especially when you produce a listening test for an audience and like, it's likely that you're talking to people who are going to be listening on 4-year-old MacBook speakers. You're not in earnest trying to contribute good information to an article like that. So that article, I just read a preview sort of explanation block, editor's note at the very beginning of that. It's like 3,000 words. It's a lot. As I'm kind of breaking down my history, working with it, and why I sort of worship at the altar of audiophile, I feel more people should. And I feel people should care about what they consume and how they consume it. And they should do so in a way that's healthier for them. And I think they would be happier. I think they would be healthier later in life. And I think it's also, if you're in any kind of media or content or creation or any kind of professional edge, it's also just better for you. So I break down a number of arguments in all of that, like the aesthetic, the artistic, and then also the professional. So it was a lot. It was 3,000 words. Kapakosh, Juan, rambling, you don't say. And lastly, this one I actually might cut down just a little bit and put this out public too. My mouse is being so funky right now. All right. I probably have malware from a mini PC on my system. OnePlus 12 camera conclusion, OnePlus open cameras for less cash. So I did a short camera review for the OnePlus 12, which on a channel like mine, a short camera review is around 11 minutes long. And I did not do the full camera deep dive. Where is my phone? I did not do the full camera deep dive for my OnePlus 12. It is exceedingly similar to the OnePlus Open, and the OnePlus Open, the most recent update for the OnePlus Open, actually makes their cameras and the app a little bit more like the OnePlus 12. So even in this OnePlus 12 camera conclusion, there is one point I make that is now already out of date. I just put this video out 3 days ago, and an update on the Open has already changed part of my conclusion for the OnePlus 12. And then you go back and you watch reviews on phones like the OnePlus 8 Pro, and they're like, well, 2 weeks before people can buy this phone, it's not as good as an iPhone. Months into owning an Open and owning a OnePlus 12, I finally produced a camera conclusion on the OnePlus 12, and 3 days later, an update has already changed part of what I talk about in that video. I don't know how to express this to people who claim to be tech enthusiasts, that they've been completely led astray. It's just like, no matter what kind of quantity, quality, what I wait for in updates, I always wait for patches before I do these like camera deep dives. And then it's almost like clockwork. As soon as I finally finish producing that content, something else arrives that changes part of what I've been trying to discuss. And I don't know how better to deliver evidence in saying, like, the evolution of your phone is one of the most critically important aspects of owning a phone. We write off companies like OnePlus, like they're not doing enough, and yet the OnePlus experience changes significantly over the life of that phone. Looking at the OnePlus 8 Pro, now end of life, it is a completely different phone than what it was at launch. They are not similar animals at all. And some people are going to be annoyed about like Oxygen OS. I don't care. It's a better phone than when it launched. But we don't have that follow through. And we have a bunch of people that are not really earnestly participating in consistent review process. I will tell you point blank, I am not unbiased. I am a biased individual. I'm a singular person, not writing for an outlet, not producing under another mantle or having some kind of review score criteria put upon me. I'm sharing my opinions, and my opinions are derived from specific things that I care about. That's a bias. That's a preference. A lot of biases and preferences are more built on whether or not the phone is going to get as much traffic in their search results and in their YouTube ad revenue and in their sponsorship deals, and not, well, how does it really perform? Well, let me get a little coffee here, and that'll wrap us up on housekeeping. We can jump in some news after that.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
All right, so that was a lot of rambling housekeeping. All of the stories, all of the links, everything that we're talking about from my Patreon posts, the somegadgetguy.com posts, YouTube videos, and then also all of the news links that we're going to share are going to be available on this week's show notes, somegadgetguy.com. I want to kick us off again with part of this political commentary. It's another article from a man crush over at Ars Technica, John Brodkin. And this is like another step in this examination of how do we rein in some of the business practices of big tech after we've crawled out of an era of very loose, almost no regulation over this sector. And I don't think we like where we've arrived. I think we've arrived at a very anti-competition place in the world of technology, where big companies can very easily absorb smaller companies directly competing against their products and services, which is technically against the law. And if they can't acquire a company, they will rush to copy that company's business model. Like we see, like for us, like I think this is going to be a really precious part of the conversation moving forward. I'm very excited about Android Bluetooth location trackers. I've been talking about this since last year, waiting for Apple to open up and finally support the standard that was created to keep people safer. Apple sat on this update for the iPhone because they have had no competition for AirTags. So they've made a product that actually made everybody less safe and profited from that. And it's only been through like examination of anti-competitive business practices, this DOJ case, that Apple is finally updating the iPhone. The iPhone has been less secure because Apple has not updated for this location tracker notification. They've actually compromised the privacy and security of their customers. And so now we in Android land are going to get a better network of devices to play with. I'm talking to folks at Chipolo and Pebblebee. But I'm going to be very anxious to see this business model was created first by companies like Tile, and Samsung had their own system of making these little tags that could track different products. Chipolo and Pebblebee have also released their own sort of networks, and Apple gave themselves preferential treatment. They gave themselves resources that they would never give to Tile, right? So if you have the Tile app on your phone, you can let the Tile app communicate with different devices and products and submit location data to the Tile network. Well, that's a much smaller group of people than everyone who owns an iPhone, an iPad, or a Mac. So Apple just built Tile's network into their own Find My Device strategy and gave themselves unlimited access to anyone who sort of casually opts in to that location tracking, which is a lot of people. And I feel like Google is kind of doing the same thing. At some point, I believe Tile has a case to say, hey, these companies sort of ripped off our business model and gave themselves special access to things that they would never give us. That is an unfair competitive advantage in apps and services for different phone platforms and different computer platforms. So, let me get this out of the way here. Sorry. Short story, incredibly long. We are wrapping up kind of an incredible first case from the DOJ going after Google and commenting on Google's business practices and the sort of relationships that Google has with apps and developers. So I've got two links here that I want to start us off with. I'm going to cue this up. And Jojo the Techie, this is exactly kind of what I'm talking about. Jojo says, I believe Tile has declined to create trackers compatible with Google's Find My Device network. To me, sorry, I'm going to click out of screen share here for just a second. To me, I feel Tile could then make an argument to an attorney general at a state level or to regulators at a federal level to say, we made this sort of business model, and now our business model has just been absorbed by Apple and Google. At some point, a regulator would have to say, well, we think maybe that's not okay. And it sucks because, like, on the one hand, I don't know what a better solution might be. If you want better location tracking services, you've got to have a population of people contributing information to that network. But on the other hand, it's like, well, we got to be tired of Apple just ripping off smaller app developers. Like, how do we fix that? So, yeah, And Joseph, absolutely, if Tile doesn't support it, they are dead. Well, then that's not a competitive market, right? That is a locked up, and I don't want to use a word like collusive. I don't know if that's the right word, but that is an anti-competitive situation to be in. All right. Just kind of touching on these, because I'd prefer folks actually read up on both of these stories. Over at Ars Technica, Google tells court it shouldn't have to distribute third-party app stores. Epic Games, Google says, Epic Games wants courts to micromanage Android app distribution. So this is from John Brodkin over at Ars Technica. Google urged a federal court to reject Epic Games' request for an injunction that would reduce Google's control of the Android app distribution and in-app payment markets. Quote, rather than a judicial injunction against alleged violations of law, Epic asks the court to create a new global regulatory regime that would set prices, impose ongoing duties to deal, and require the court to micromanage on an ongoing basis a highly complex and dynamic ecosystem that is used by billions of consumers and millions of app developers and that supports the business of hundreds of OEMs and carriers around the world. Stated, Google's objections filed yesterday in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. So this is going to be a tough fight for Google. Right now, the sort of regulatory feel in the air that we're seeing right now has been hypercritical of the big companies' business practices. And nowhere is that more apparent than on the search side of this, where... sorry, this is a video, so I'm not going to play the whole video. But I also, like I said, I want folks to see this stuff. Go read the article from John Brodkin over at Ars Technica. And then also, this is an Associated Press video. Federal judge hears closing arguments in the Google antitrust case. So we're seeing multiple actions. We've got the Northern District of California revisiting the relationship between Google and an app game developer, game store like Epic. This has always been curious to me why there's been so much pushback from Google for these types of alternative app stores. We had the Humble Bundle game store. There's no reason why Steam couldn't put out games, Android apps. Now, Netflix is kind of a game service, but it still houses the individual apps on Google Play. But we've had other solutions, like I still load F-Droid. F-Droid is an open source platform community of developers, and you can find really cool little applets and services that are open, like free open source software. And they're updated through F-Droid. They're not updated through Google Play. And I know a lot of people try to act like, oh, but security, and oh, you're going to get malware. But you kind of have to go out of your way to find shady repositories and find like, oh, this is a cracked game. Well, that's a terrible idea. It's a terrible idea on Windows, and it's a terrible idea on Android. So maybe just don't do that, and you'll be much better off with fighting malware. So this most recent DOJ case, though, this federal case, is very interesting as it pertains to search, because I don't feel... Google's lawyers have done a great job of arguing on behalf of Google search and services. If the argument from Google is, we're the best, we exist as the primary search engine for all of these products and all of these compute platforms because we genuinely give the best results to consumers searching on Google. They've done a terrible job of supporting that argument when it's also been disclosed that Google has these revenue deals with all of the manufacturers that use Google Search. And they've done an even poorer job of supporting that argument when a revenue deal for an Android manufacturer is like half of the revenue deal that they have with Apple. So Google has entered into an unfair or disproportionately beneficial business relationship with Apple. Again, I am not a lawyer. I am not qualified to use words like collusive, but that speaks to me as being a lopsided or an unfair business agreement. And it chips away at the strength of the argument that Google's lawyers are making when it comes to Google search being the bestest. If Google search is the bestest, then why do you pay Apple twice the search revenue for Google to be the default search engine on the iPhone? Why are you paying Apple? Now, I believe the estimate, and someone please correct me if I have this math wrong, I believe the estimate is Apple is earning roughly $20 billion a year by making Google the default. All of these iPhone people that are acting like, well, Apple doesn't profit off of our privacy, Apple doesn't profit off of our user data and our behavior, and Apple's making, at least in the last estimate that I saw, Apple is making roughly $20 billion a year to just kind of hand you off to Google. So if you're an Apple fan, if you're an iPhone fan, I would be concerned about that business practice. If you've made a choice to say, well, I don't want Google doing all this stuff to me, Apple cares about my privacy. They don't. Apple absolutely does not. So it's a pair of articles. It's a pair of stories that are detailing the relationship that Google has as a platform, as a search provider, and as a distributor of software with the companies that advertise on their platforms and the companies that host the software that you can download, install, consume, buy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this, to me, it's such an important part of this conversation because for some reason, consumers and even tech enthusiasts have sort of compartmentalized the phone as being something structurally different than a laptop or a desktop. If you bought a new Windows PC and Microsoft got in your face and said, you have to install your software from the Microsoft Store, would you stick with that PC? I would not. I would go and I would install a Linux distro on that PC. I would work with all of my family and friends to make sure that they were not buying computers that were that restrictive in how you sourced, installed, and updated software. That would not be okay. But for some reason, that has become the business model of the smartphone, and we've all just sort of accepted, oh, well, yeah, I mean, if you buy an iPhone, you have to get your apps through the App Store. That's why you have to pay Apple 30% just for access, just so developers can access the people who use iPhones. And if you replace Apple and iPhone with Microsoft and Windows, you would never entertain that kind of conversation. You would immediately mock that situation where, what do you mean I can't install any software that I want to install on my laptop? But we don't think that way with phones. A phone is this appliance, this TikTok streaming commodity appliance. And it's in the marketplace of ideas, we've just sort of lost the ground on that fight. So now we're making up for it, and we're seeing some really brutal arguments coming out of court cases, class actions, these DOJ actions. And I feel like the entire structure of how we do business on mobile is being reexamined. I hope we come out the other side with at least some better consumer protection, some better consumer buffers. It doesn't mean we need to fundamentally, you know, dismantle an app store, you know, like Google Play or the Apple App Store, but it means that we need to reexamine the pocket computer is a computer. And if you choose to install software on that computer, you should be able to go and buy that software directly from the manufacturer, directly from the developer, get it supported directly from the company that puts out the updates. And if Google is not a part of that relationship, Google does not deserve a cut of the developer's revenue. That, to me, is a fundamental aspect of like traditional computer market that we are lacking on our phones and mobile devices. Let me You just get another drink of coffee. This mouse, it's killing me. It's like, just like, it's getting stuck. It's so frustrating. Yeah, Dr. Claw, I use F-Droid for Fennec and no phone spam. F-Droid is just really fun to troll through. You find great little services in there. I really dig it. excuse me. McCorkran is saying, come on. There we go. If it has open source code, there's no profit motive. So people who write open source software still want to make money on their software, but often it's more donationware or like in corporate Linux distros. It's about paying for support, you know, deployment and maintenance and stuff like that. But there's a reason why open source still continues to generate interest and discussion. And that is a viable business model that people could consider. And also, McCorkran, this is hilarious. Google's argument seems to be about its size, which actually works against it in this context. It's like, we're not a monopoly. We just dominate search, and we pay people to include us as the default search engine. It's like, they're not even trying to say the quiet parts quietly. It's like, they're saying the quiet parts up front and out loud. And this is like, again, we've heard of, like, people have brought up phrases. I'm not coining this phrase. You know, with banks, it was too big to fail. Well, with tech, it seems too big to care. And there's an apathy. Apple operates in this hyper-corporate shareholder investment strategy, which just seems like Apple is too big to really care about the people who buy their products. They care about their shareholders. They care about their stock price. And similarly, when we talk about the executive leadership at Apple, the executive leadership at Google, the executive leadership at Amazon, these services are not improving for end users. These companies are acting like they're too big to care. And that means they don't have competition. And if they had competition, they would be more anxious about providing products and services that actually meet our needs and improve over time, as opposed to us constantly feeling like we're getting ratcheted for better monetization. I've got one other just sort of like tech social media story. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this. I just think it's kind of interesting and sad. I've never been a fan of Jack Dorsey, but we shared this around on the Discord on first, this is where I caught it, was Jack Dorsey departs Blue Sky board. Blue Sky's most prominent, this is written up by Anthony Ha over at TechCrunch. Blue Sky's most prominent backer has left its board. On Saturday, Jack Dorsey posted on X about grants for open protocols from his philanthropic Start Small initiative. This prompted someone to ask Dorsey if he was still on the Blue Sky board, and he responded with a terse no. Dorsey did not answer any of the follow-up posts asking him to explain his departure. Instead, over the last couple days, he's basically just ratcheted everything down. He's deleted almost every other social media presence that he currently has. And he's now just a member of the cult of Freeze Peach over on Twitter. And that's it. It's just really sad. I've never been a fan of Jack Dorsey. I felt like he's always had an agenda that runs counter to sort of the proposed claims of what he's trying to create for social media platforms. One of the biggest obstacles for me embracing Blue Sky was the fact that this was a Jack Dorsey joint. I did not trust that his intentions were honorable with Blue Sky, but now that he's gone, I'm kind of feeling like I can take Blue Sky more seriously. Just as Blue Sky has started to open up this protocol where people can plug in other social media style services into the Blue Sky network, that's when Jack Dorsey leaves and then starts this whiny baby, take my ball and go home. Well, guys, if you really want free speech, you've got to go over to Twitter. They platform fascists over on Twitter. That's what you need. You need the free speech. So it's just, kind of a hilarious turn of events. I want to share this. This is from Blue Sky and the current like official Blue Sky account. We sincerely thank Jack for his help funding and initiating the Blue Sky project. Today, Blue Sky is thriving as an open source social network running on @proto, @proto. I don't know if that's how you say it. The decentralized protocol we have built. With Jack's departure, we are searching for a new board member for the Blue Sky public benefit company who shares our commitment to building a social network that puts people in control of their experience. More to come. And it's like a kind of a killing with kindness, but a hilarious, snarky little, well, Jack's gone. Who wants to jump in? Is anyone, you want to come join us now? We've got the opening on our board. It was everything I could do to not reply to like stories again on like Mastodon. Jack Dorsey is leaving Blue Sky. And I actually had to stop myself from just a reply comment, and nothing of value was lost. I find it, sorry, let me take a drink of water. This is just cracking me up. There we go. Yeah, nothing of value was lost. I don't know how other people feel. I am so tired of sort of spoiled rich people who have kind of found some success or stumbled into some interesting projects. But then acting like I feel like someone like a Jack Dorsey is starting to believe his own mythology surrounding himself as a brand, right? I don't really have a good way to describe this kind of self-involved idea. To me, it's almost kind of like a tech narcissism. But those words are inadequate to fully describe what I feel is kind of the mechanism at play. But you're sort of a part of creating the Twitter that we sort of experienced and understood as being this in the moment microblogging service. You leave and you start this other project, and then you leave that project to go back, and the Twitter that you go back to is a poor shadow facsimile of what it was when you originally left. So I don't know. Oh, Dr. Claw, again, I mean, just like clawing and scratching for any kind of relevance. Dr. Claw says, Jack Dorsey showed up tweeting this weekend over Kendrick versus Drake. It's a trending topic, and I too am topical. Pay attention to me, for I am Jack Dorsey. It's just so thirsty. It's just, man, you know, there's so many other things that we could be like paying attention to and doing better about. And Jack Dorsey doesn't seem to be really contributing much to this overall situation. So I can now delete this TechCrunch tab in my browser. I also feel like we probably should bring this up. Who wants to talk about funky little AI products? Right? Like, y'all are wearing your AI pins with your Rabbit AI virtual assistants, right? Is that we've all gotten rid of the smartphone because the phone is an old device that has a screen and it's demonstrated a practical, disruptive computing solution. And it's disrupted camera sales and media player sales. It destroyed the MP3 market and the point-and-shoot camera market. And it can in some ways, some people were saying, Pakistan is saying for later discussion, are there any laptops with another power delivery to sustain or even charge the Steam Deck? Well, I mean, laptops came from this idea of turning our phone into a computer. So all of that's gone now. And you have like a little pin on your shirt that projects information into the palm of your hand, or you hold up this little square and it's got like a little hardware button on it so that you can just talk to AI. That's what people are doing these days, right? Well, the Rabbit is an app. There was an elegant way for me to manage that transition. I need to bring this up here from my buddy Michelle. Come on. Rabbit R1, a thing that should just be an app, actually is just an Android app updated. So apparently the Rabbit R1 is this tiny little Android-powered device, and the Rabbit software is kind of just an APK that you can rip from this AOSP product, and folks seem to be fine loading that APK onto a traditional Android device, an Android phone or tablet, and then you get the Rabbit experience in a phone. So I am not super bullish on this consumer-facing business model for AI. But I feel Rabbit, and what was the pin? Was it Humane? Was that the company that made the pin? This is part of the reason why I'm not super bullish on consumer AI as any kind of disruptive growth business model for tech. If this were a new era of consumer electronics, new products, new services, getting consumers and end users, I'm talking consumer stuff, getting people really excited about new ways to interact with data and services, I believe we would see a much more robust competitive developer environment. You would see little upstart companies, you would see little like angel investor money getting thrown around. A startup would be able to approach this market and bring something of value to the experience. I don't believe that can happen. AI is really only drawing the top talent to massive corporations. A really talented AI engineer is not going to go to a little startup working out of someone's garage to disrupt the AI landscape. That little startup is not going to have the tools to really allow that developer to explore the full scope of their AI ambitions. That developer is only going to want to go to the company that can afford to outfit that developer with racks and racks and servers full of like MPUs and GPUs and crazy data processing capabilities. So before AI has really taken root as a consumer-facing experience, something that we might depend on in our daily life to really interact with information, we've already sewn up, well, you've got Microsoft, you've got Google. Apple is currently using Google infrastructure to fulfill their current AI needs. You've got Amazon, you've got Meta. Tesla is sort of out there talking about some AI plays, but for products that you can really actually use, the platforms are managed by these massive server-side data center corporations. A tiny Palo Alto garage band of developers can't unseat Gemini. You can't out-Google Google. You have to pay rent to Google or Microsoft to use their AI platforms. So then you can put your own models in and you can use their hardware and blah, 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 blah. And I'm sure that when you put your models and your software and your information on like, you know, like a Gemini infrastructure, I'm sure it's perfectly firewalled and just no data or telemetrics or user behavior or any information make it to Google that would enrich Google products and services. Perish the thought. So when I see something like the Rabbit R1, it's not a unique AI experience. I totally respect what they tried to accomplish was a unique piece of hardware that should facilitate a slightly different interaction with content than the way that we pick up our phone. I'm actually thirsty for that idea, but I want that in a heads-up display. I want a smartwatch at a level, and I had that, and it was amazing. And we don't have that now, and I'm very sad. That's the kind of thing I'm looking for. I don't want AI audio glasses. I want smartwatch at eye level. I don't need AI for smartwatch at eye level. But I at least respect that what Rabbit was trying to accomplish was this form factor dictates a different kind of interaction than what you can currently do with your phone. That's the pitch. That was the claim. The claim has not proven true. I respect the marketing initiative, and I respect the desire, because I think a lot of people out there are looking for some kind of post-smartphone experience. That's not what was really delivered when you can rip off a very simple piece of software from the hardware and put that on any other hardware, and it seems to replicate that experience. So you've not created an actual unique interactive exchange. But I think it speaks to the fact that we really want these things. So I know, like, I kind of went off on a little bit of a tangent sort of earlier in the podcast talking about, like, massive YouTube channels. Like, someone who's coming out and saying, like, oh, man, the Humane Pin, it's a completely unusable device. And, oh, the Rabbit R1, just another gimmick, and it's totally, it could be an app. And we then sort of sidetrack the conversation, like, are these YouTube influencers killing these products? Well, no, but it was also just really low-hanging fruit. I'm not bullish on AI. I think a lot of consumers join me in my sentiment. I don't see AI in this, let me ask it a question and I might get a good answer or I might not get a good answer. Hasn't made search better. Hasn't made online interactions better. And it's made a lot of interactions demonstrably worse. So that's easy. That's low-hanging fruit. You already have the bias and the preferences of a vast number of tech consumers. So all that is just confirming what they already felt about AI. That also plays out in bad ways too, though. It also plays out when a phone might have something interesting to offer, but it's not good enough. You know, the popular phones are iPhones and Galaxies. So those are the phones that are always going to be worth it because they're already selling a lot and they're already popular. And to me, they're cut of similar cloth. I'm bothered by criticism of the R1. I'm not going to buy an R1. I don't think you should buy an R1. If you really, really want to play with that specific hardware experience, sure, go buy a Humane, go buy a pin with a projector, or go buy Rabbit R1. I don't need to review those products to kind of assert that that doesn't satisfy my preference and that doesn't really contribute to what I want out of a tech product. But I also feel like we're not really being consistent in how we evaluate and how we express criticism on the performance of these products. Instead, I feel we are ratcheting consumers to follow the trends of a YouTube platform, empowering an inconsistent review process which highlights popularity above all else. If this channel is in a lot of other viewers' watch history, it gets promoted more on the YouTube algorithm. And if it's getting promoted more, that creator needs to keep producing content at a level where they don't get devalued by the YouTube algorithm. So it just becomes a cycle, a self-perpetuating cycle of spoon-feeding people the thing that they already know. But that means that we've lost out on numerous products and experiments that have been, I think, unfairly criticized by this review process. So the Rabbit R1 is not evidence of, you know, like, oh, well, this YouTuber killed this product. The Rabbit R1 is not a great hill to die on. But to me, it still embodies the core disease. We're seeing all the symptoms of it. Sometimes those symptoms affect viable products, and sometimes those symptoms confirm crappy products should not be purchased. The disease is still affecting both of those conversations. So, I don't want to try and make it sound like there is nothing about AI that is going to be a benefit to consumers ever. But what I currently see is rampant IP theft. Google is working very hard to make their investment in infrastructure and servers more commercially viable. And they're doing that at the expense of website traffic. So they pull all this information from the internet, and then they deliver that information on their own platforms, and they start to highlight search results, other things like Reddit, where Reddit has seen this skyrocket in traffic shortly after Google started paying Reddit millions of dollars a year for access to their information. This is, to me, the peripheral or anecdotal evidence of anti-competitive business practices. And that filters all the way down into how a big YouTube channel tracks their metrics, their viewership, and what they need to do to appease the algorithm so they can keep making more money. It's all a part of the same disease. They're just different symptoms at play. Rabbit R1 was not a good example of what AI might bring. I don't think advanced language learning models are going to be sexy, exciting products for consumers. I think at some point, they'll just be these mundane things that kind of live in your system. And I'll be way more interested in these types of services when I get a new computer and it's kind of dumb. But there's this little enclave on the computer that operates on my information in this little protected enclave. And if I'm disconnected from the internet, that enclave still has things like a backup of my calendar, a backup of my notes and recipes, a backup of my most recent email, and I can work with that computer offline and come up with calendar entries, reminders, practical daily life content, interactions. I think that would be a really cool next step for a lot of these like NPUs and local neural processing cores, things like that. I'm not interested in, like, I just did it again today for the podcast. I hit up Microsoft Copilot and I'm just, what'll it tell me? What was the most popular tech news story published this morning? And then I wait, and then I wait, and then it starts kind of searching out a reply, and it's like a story about AI. Like, okay. I don't see any news outlets really talking about the story, Microsoft Copilot. Like, you sent me something that is kind of irrelevant to the question that I asked you. That's not it. I don't feel like that was a valuable use of my time. It took a really long time to get a result from that question casually asked. But if my computer were offline and I still say, hey, what do I have going on next Tuesday? And do you think we can, you know, schedule in? I want to have lunch with my wife next Wednesday. And my daughter has a performance at school. So can you give me a calendar entry reminder about that? And you can more organically flow through those interactions. It's not as regimented and as segmented an experience that we currently have with voice assistants. Then I think that's when we'll find the actual practical daily lifestyle experience meet the AI expectations that consumers might have. But that's not as sexy or as exciting as these companies trying to make it sound. So let me just get a quick drink of water here, and then we got a couple of these comments here that I want to get to.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
I started Tech Potato with a vision. I'd already been covering processes and technology for 10 years as senior editor for Inantech, but only through the written word. With today's media so diverse, I chose to one-up my vision and move to video and explain the nuance of complex topics. Hi, my name's Ian Cutteris and I'm Chief Spud at Tech Potato. The goal at Tech Potato is to have fun, to talk about areas of the technology industry that aren't always covered. Sometimes there are non-obvious aspects to a topic which doesn't always come across in written media, and that's where I strike. The channel is also there to shine a light into the areas that most end users don't even know exist. There's also a tongue-in-cheek joke. Processors are called chips, and just like a bag of chips, I like to get my teeth into these things, hence Tech Potato. The thumbnails are stupid, but the content is real. If you're interested about how things in this technology industry work, or for reports on behind-the-scenes events, plus some classic British humor, then head on over. You'll be welcome with open arms.
Yeah, Michael Corcoran, exactly. We are in total agreement. We are already benefiting from AI. It's just the successive consumer push for these generative language models are so disappointing and overhyped. And every time now I see like Sam Altman in the news, I'm like, it's fake. Oh, we got some other people here kind of chatting. Let me just kind of scroll back right now. From Kapakash, that's why I laugh at people that say how Apple AI will be all on device. I'm like, keep believing what Apple says. Because again, it's like, they're paying for Gemini right now, guys. Like, that's not... It's not... Okay, yeah, sorry. From Alsabakli, it was low-hanging fruit because it was also genuinely useless products. You can't compare that to lenient reviews of otherwise functional products. The amount of useless with Humane Pin and Rabbit is actually unreal. But like I said, I you're completely correct. I don't disagree with you there. I do feel like it is still a symptom of a confirmation bias style of review, as opposed to taking devices on their own merit. This time it lined up that, yes, these things are functionally useless. But in the past, it has not like I will die on that hill. Focals by North were practical, eye level, smartwatch heads up display glasses. And how many videos did you see earlier on their launch? Oh, just wait for Gen 2 or Gen 3, guys. Oh, they're sort of wacky, and you're not familiar with heads up display glasses. You remember Google Glass? Glass holes. And that was not an earnest review process for the capabilities of that product. It was dredging up baggage like Google Glass. It was talking to an audience that was not familiar with the experience and not helping them understand what that experience was. So those people already had a bias against face computers. All you had to do was confirm that bias, and you did significant harm to the idea of a heads-up display. Now we're trying to make it happen again. But Apple couldn't pull it off. So what do we do? If Apple can't pull it off, then I don't have Apple in the headlines of my videos. So I'm not getting enough search. I'm not getting enough traffic. That isn't popular enough. And that, to me, is the problem when we have an inconsistent review process that's based more on confirmation bias and popularity. Michael Corcoran, the scary part is if I ask it a question on anything I know anything about, I realize how wrong it is. It makes me worry about all the questions I ask where I have no expertise. I think that is definitely getting confirmed by a lot of people right now. Because there were also things like the books that people were trying to publish based on AI writing things about, like, one of the early stories, and I bet you that this has gotten better, but one of the early stories I think was like a foraging guide. Like how to forage for food, survival guide. And it was like published on Amazon. And then it was realized like, oh, this is AI and it's all fake. It's all garbage information. And some of it, like if you can even find the plants they're talking about, would like instantly kill you. Let me get that right here. Grounded Tech. Some crappy products can go on to be great in future iterations, but people seem determined to kill things off before giving them a chance. I am very anxious about any new flavor of an experience we already understand. I mean, if you follow my channel, you have heard me whinge on incessantly for the last, 3 years, 4 years, about how I want a smartwatch up at eye level. And I need it to just be that. Notifications, short pieces of information, glanceable things that come in, and rich notification reaction support so that I don't have to look down at my watch and break eye contact with you. The organic experience of just living in the world and having access and awareness of pieces of information in my digital sphere of influence was only satisfied by Focals by North. And again, before it, I didn't spend nearly as much time on Google Glass. But again, of a similar kind of experience, just focals were so much more discreet. Well, that's a little unfamiliar. So again, it's easy to dig a grave for that because not a lot of people have experienced it. So because a lot of people haven't experienced it, you can poop all over it. And people nod along. Oh, and see, they didn't even succeed. The Focal's business model, well, that wasn't viable. So I guess it just wasn't ready for prime time. And I'm telling you, it was the single best smartwatch-style experience I've ever consumed. It was faster. It was more discreet. It had amazing speech-to-text and reply capabilities. It was fun. It put information in the most accessible way for me to interact with it. And you should all be sad that you don't have it. I am sad that I got to play with it and it no longer exists. If you didn't get to play with it, you really missed out on something special. But, you know, they were kind of expensive, I guess. I don't know. That's hard to say. Oh, Nick Gay. Juan seriously needs to do a call-in show because this is a conversation I want to be a part of. So I am trying to fix. So for April Fool's, I had everything set up and I did a test run of it and it worked brilliantly. And then on the day, I tried to do a live stream where we could make this more of like a Clubhouse style conversation. People could like, you know, come to the stage and share audio and stuff. And it all broke. So considering how many meltdowns I have over audio anyway, it was pretty bad. JGJ, I want AR subtitle glasses when I don't understand certain languages. You could have had them. Focals by North would have worked great for that kind of, you know, again, putting information up at eye level and having a translation layer. Would have been awesome. You could have had that 4 years ago. You can kind of do it now with like the wearable displays that, you know, like I show off the Rokids, like here are my Rokid Max. You can kind of do some stuff like that with sort of screen sharing and mirroring, and sometimes you can do like an app that plugs into it. The problem is that now you've got it on glasses like these. So these are the TCL Ray Neo X2. And no. This is a hard pass. This is a hard pass for me. It has an AR translation app built into it. I'm not wearing these. Look at how much they're depressing the tops of my ears. Like that's uncomfortable. I just put them on my skull. These are already uncomfortable to wear, let alone will I try to make it through a significant part of my day with this on my face. And if I could have just gotten these displays in the Focals and the Focals frame, which were a little bit more nose heavy, but they didn't have all of this extra like baggage on the back of my skull too, I'd be better off. If we had had 4 years of iteration on the Focals by North, we would have all these things that people talk about. Real-time language translation. We'd have turn-by-turn directions. The walking directions on the Focals were awesome. So you'd get like these arrows that just kind of guide you. Oh, it's time to turn left. Okay. they were incredible. We had it. It was real. But, I don't know, guys. Maybe wait for Gen 2 or Gen 3. They're just not ready for prime time. Maybe Google will buy them out and then kill that project. That's what we need. Yeah, cake batter. I would be interested in a Google Glass 2024 edition. So I forget what the name of it. Project Iris. Read up on Project Iris because two Google I/Os ago, they showed very simple, sleek frames. Google bought out the North team, the Focals by North team. And we were going to get, one of the main things that they were showing was real-time translation, just in this waveguide optic glasses setup. And then we started getting all the big news about Vision Pro, Apple's mixed reality headset. And Samsung convinced Google that if Google wanted to make an operating system for glasses, Samsung did not want Google engineers to also be working on their own hardware. So they killed Project Iris. And instead, they opted for Samsung's design on a headset-like system, which has still never come to light. Because Vision Pro, Apple's mixed reality headset, isn't really taking the world by storm. So Samsung making a poorer version of Apple's mixed reality headset is not engendering a lot of excitement with techies. So we lost it. We again lost a practical, sleek, daily wearable, simple information, eye level. Would have been a good platform maybe to try something like Gemini connected to your phone. Could have been great. We could have had it. It was ready to be shown in early demos. They did a whole commercial with people organically using this to translate like languages from their family members and stuff. It looked brilliant. But it's gone now. It's gone now. And it's gone in part, in a small part, not the whole part, but in a small part, because when we had these products, we told people not to buy them and to wait for refinement that never came. And that's what kills me about this, like, this resistant to new idea, resistant to new form factor style of reviewing. It's not popular, so we can't recommend it. That is not a fair assessment of the capabilities of that product. Let me get out of the way here. let me get this out of the way. And a couple people were bringing up channels specifically, and I don't even think that this is like a specific YouTuber kind of problem. The core disease is YouTube. The core disease is YouTube's algorithm, which focuses on the popularity and the trendiness of a topic. And then all of the channels either have to play ball if they want to keep making money, or they just aren't relevant anymore, and they slide out of the popularity of the YouTube algorithm. So again, I'm not really trying to tag any one specific creator, but when I mention these massive channels that have millions of subscribers, I do not believe they earnestly approach reviews with consistency. I believe they look at what is the expected reaction from our audience, and if we cater to that audience's bias, then we'll also get outrage traffic from people who do like this product or service. So it works on both sides. If there's a tiny group of people that loved the Focals by North, they got outsized impact from that small community from people being upset at their reviews, you know, degrading the product. You can't win if you are constantly fighting the YouTube platform for that kind of search bias. Grounded Tech, those look super uncomfortable. From Ali, those glasses are just missing the giant nose to be joke glasses. I am so sad. The Ray Neo X2 were high on my list as like some of the most important product to review in 2024. And now I'm so deflated, I don't even want to make a video about these. I did a first impressions on the Patreon, and maybe I'll just publish that first impressions with like a little bit of a tune-up as a public article. But there's already like no interest in these glasses. The videos have already kind of died on social media. And to me, this is a lot like Apple's mixed reality headset as a conversation, where I am not excited at all for Apple's headset, but I am critically anxious that Apple's headset has helped us move forward on developing better micro OLEDs. So future headsets will have higher resolution displays because Apple did nudge manufacturing forward. That's it. That's the only thing that I think is viable, like really contributes to the ecosystem of mixed reality headsets. The X2 here, these are not good daily wearable AR notification heads-up display glasses. so many problems with this setup and how it talks to your phone and how the app communicates and moves information around, and even just dumb things like you take a photo on these and it's like a four-step process to get the photo from the glasses onto your phone, then saved to your phone, and then available in your phone's photo gallery. But the thing that I am critically excited about is the waveguide optics. So you notice, like, I have, like, a weird lens or a prism or other glasses, like Rokids and the other TCLs have what we call a bird bath optic. And so you can see, like, there's this big, like, scoop. So the OLED is actually pointing down from the top of the glass, and then this periscope-style birdbath optic points that back into your eye, and it expands the field of view. The only thing that's working here on the X2 are these waveguides, where you can see as I move, there's like a little rectangle in, right there. You see that rectangle catching the light at this off angle? Well, you can see that, but I can't. I can see some internal reflection, but it's not a distinct color rectangle like you can see it now on video. But for me, it's a very good transparent panel, a transparent lens. But then when information pops up, I can see it very clearly. And it is so much easier to share what that looks like with someone else than we ever had with Focals by North or with Google Glass. Focals and Google Glass required you to make structural hardware changes that better biologically fit the user. This is much more accessible. A broader community of people can just pick these up, put them on their face, and see what they want to see. That's the progress. The waveguide optics are so much more practical for a daily wearable heads-up display. It's just the whole rest of the packaging, presentation, and support. None of this is ready for people to really wear it 24/7, 365. It's not there. And that makes me really, really sad. So now I'm hoping that another company, like maybe a Vuzix, you know, they make all those industrial headsets for like warehouses and like government work and stuff like that. If they can make like a sort of a consumer style headset, but instead of having a bird bath or a prism, they can use the waveguide optics, that would be so much better than what the X2 is currently doing. Ron Guido, no joke. Somewhere Google has a bat cave full of cool stuff. Oh, Ali, you've been taking it back to people, you know, dumping on HTC and LG and OnePlus. It's all bad. Ha Sam says, ha ha, they look so silly. Ha Sam, I think that is very kind of you. I want to use stronger language on my generally PG podcast about what I think they look like, because even silly isn't how I would describe the X2. So we're kind of coming into the end here. I did want to just briefly showcase some of the Xperia leaks. Evan Blass, EV Leaks, has basically detailed all of Sony's marketing. So we've got like the best still images of what the Xperia 1 Mark 6 is going to look like. We've got confirmation on the cameras, a 16mm ultra-wide, 24mm main camera sensor, and an 85-170 telephoto, a variable optic telephoto. The only thing we don't know is what camera sensors. I should have said camera lenses, but we don't know what sensors are going to be in each of those cameras. But we know they all will be XMORE T, just like the Xperia 1 Mark 5. They were all high-speed readout stacked sensors. 5,000 milliamp hour battery. It looks like we're getting yet another evolution to the cooling on the Xperia 1 Mark 6. And it just looks like overall kind of an interesting iterative take on the Sony Xperia 1. I am getting to a point where I'm increasingly anxious, and I'm feeling more and more confident in saying that the accessibility of the Xperia 1 in North America is likely going to be reduced. It's either going to be a much later launch for Xperia 1 Mark 6 in the United States, long after Sony has satisfied demand in Japan and China, and then maybe sent some phones out to the EU, or this might be the first year, this might be the first year that we just don't get an Xperia in North America. The reason why I'm kind of feeling that way is normally there's some other type of PR chatter or some type of pre-brief. Even if I'm not sort of in line to get a review device, usually some part of Sony PR has opened up and we've had a conversation. And right now, Sony PR USA is totally radio silent. I would, if I were under embargo, I would just say, oh, I can't talk about the phone. Well, I'm not under embargo. They're not talking to me at all. So if there is some kind of review strategy for North America, it is very different than what it's been in years past. Oh, John Gao. If this is true, I think this is disaster. John Gao says there is a rumor that Xperia will skip the Chinese mainland market as well. China is a massive sales point for the Xperia team. In the way that an expensive phone is held up as some kind of status symbol, it wasn't a huge seller in terms of numbers, obviously. Like, Sony's market share is like a fraction of a single percentage of the smartphone market in China. But when you look at it through the lens of how many phones does Sony sell every year, China was a huge part of moving that and also imbuing the brand with some kind of special feeling. It's an emotional flex of, it's an exclusive device. An iPhone is not exclusive. A Galaxy is not exclusive. A Sony, well, you don't see those every day. Someone who picked up a Sony picked it up with purpose. They picked it up because they have taste. You know, like that was a part of that conversation when it came to Japan and China as singular markets for cell phones. But right now, that doesn't read in North America. There is no one cares about your Android phone in North America. It's not a status symbol. Your text color bubbles are your status symbol. So I'll be very anxious to see. We're going to get some more news next week, or is it next Friday? Is it the 17th? We'll probably get more of these confirmations. But if you want to see all of the marketing slides, EV Leaks has already put all of that content out. You can catch all that stuff. DTNL, Sony North American PR and Juan go to couples counseling. 3-part miniseries on Only Juans. I don't know. I mean, it's like I've done a lot of work with Sony PR. I've even done some consulting work with Sony PR. I've really enjoyed working with the Sony team, but they also get their marching orders from Japan. They are not empowered to really lead conversation and discussion and marketing in all of these smaller regions. So if it doesn't move to sell more Alpha cameras, I don't think the Sony Alpha team really cares what the perception of the Xperia is in the United States. And so much so that that's one of the reasons why I don't think we're going to get another Xperia Pro. Sony took all the parts and pieces of the Xperia Pro, and they've made a really interesting camera monitor. It's a broadcast solution. It's got a full-size HDMI. I think it has an Ethernet port on there. You can plug it directly through the USB-C into an Alpha camera, use it as a broadcast brain, and also record directly to the monitor. And it looks like a bucket of parts from older Xperia phones, but in a new shell to make it a really interesting portable monitor solution for the Sony Alpha. So Sony put the Xperia under the umbrella of the camera division, and I feel the camera division has kind of learned everything they need to learn from the phone. Now, what they're concerned about is making sure that Sony demonstrates a dominance in mirrorless cameras and in camera sensor technology. So the phone is not really necessary for that anymore. The Xperia doesn't really contribute to that if it's not a crown jewel profit motivating. It's okay that, like, the Xperia division is not in the red. That's why we've gotten as many Xperias as we've had, but it's not growing and building into being a singular status product in all regions. So again, I kind of feel like when the Xperia 5 didn't come to North America is potentially evidence that the Xperia 1 also might not come to the United States. let me get out of the way here. And then we're just kind of wrapping up here. I was going to talk a little bit more about Apple and iPads, and I think we still can talk about that too, but someone else mentioned the Vivo X100S Ultra. I just want to pull that up here real quick. I don't know, Gizmo China, that's fine. I'll add this to the show notes, to the links. Excuse me. So, let me get this out of the way here. I can say without reservation, the recent update from the Vivo X90 Pro to the Vivo X100 Pro, as much as I love Xiaomi cameras, and I still have my Xiaomi 13 Ultra, still use it a ton. I've got my Xiaomi 14. I haven't spent any time with the 14 Ultra, but what little time I've shot on the Xiaomi 14 Ultra, there are a few things that the less expensive Vivo X100 Pro does a little bit better for my current workflow. And little changes to the software, to the experience, to how it handles things like external microphones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's something really lovely about this price to performance. I'm very anxious to see if Vivo can really improve upon that experience and not deliver just a prohibitively expensive product. We're going to call it an ultra-tier device, and that means we should be expecting prices well above $1,000. Depending on region and estimates and price and currency, it could be like a $1,400 phone, just like a Xiaomi 14 Ultra. This new telephoto, I think, could be a really interesting development. If we're really getting a good amount of reach and it's going to a larger image sensor, that is one of the structural... It was one of the most brutal structural advantages of Vivo and Xiaomi. Samsung finally figured this out too. If you give me a little less reach, so you don't have as much zoom, but you can use a significantly larger sensor on that lens, we end up with a much more flexible solution. Oppo and OnePlus are doing this really well too. So you only have a 3x zoom. It's a 70-ish millimeter equivalent lens on the OnePlus 12. But this telephoto is so much more usable in high contrast lighting, low light, nighttime, indoors. You want to use it more in a variety of different shooting situations. Right now, I kind of feel the best version of that is on the X100 Pro. As I picked it up, Vivo's light and HDR and image processing is crazy fast. It's just incredible what you can accomplish through this telephoto. If you remember, like a couple weeks back, I talked about my cousin's wedding, and I shot their like private religious ceremony from the Vivo X100 Pro. And I'm getting like close up, head and shoulders. I'm across a dark, backlit living room, and it's pulling out like HDR background information from this beautiful window that was behind them, but I'm exposing properly for their faces. They're pulled out of the shadow detail. Vivo's ability to maximize light in any situation is second to none. So if we get an even larger image sensor, that could be really interesting. I don't care at all about this rumor that it's like a 200 megapixel sensor. I don't care. I'm going to shoot 12 megapixel stills. That's all it's going to be. But what I want to see is whether or not we do get a phone that has this sensor size improvement, will it be an international launch? I think Xiaomi did it right. You have the Xiaomi 14 and the 14 Ultra as the international flavors. And then there is the Xiaomi 14 Pro, which is a very good phone, but that was the China-only model. The Xiaomi 14 is a monster for a smaller, more reasonable, medium-sized phone. The Xiaomi 14 Ultra is their crown jewel. Everyone in the world gets to see what that thing can do. The 14 Pro is kind of in that middle spot where it's really the more practical daily driver than the Ultra, but it's not as exciting. I feel like that should be the strategy. I would really love to see Vivo do something similar to that, where we used to get the Vivo X Pro Plus. That was their version of an Ultra. I'd love to see the Ultra get the international release, but right now I'm not sure this is that's what we're going to get. I think we're going to see the Vivo end up as a China exclusive, the Ultra as a Chinese exclusive, and we'll just have to kind of like view it from afar, whether or not I can get my hand on one, because I really can't keep buying Chinese variant phones. Al Sepagli was asking specifically, do you think we'll get that new Vivo Ultra? And I don't know. Right now, I know we're in line for a Chinese launch, but I don't see any good, credible evidence that it's going to get the international launch. I just really want it to.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, meaudio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
From Nikkei, I need to ask, does 200 megapixels give you better print versus 12 or 50 megapixels? From everything that I've seen in handling, and this is mostly through handling Samsungs, so you have to view my experiences through the lens of Samsung's aggressive image processing software. Excuse me. In a very controlled, best case situation for lighting, you can save a 200 megapixel photo. All of the dots account to 200 million pixels. I don't believe, even with a ton of post-processing, demosaicing the image sensor, and sharpening and upscaling and how we process that final JPEG, I still don't think you see 200 megapixel resolution resolved by the lens. When I compare Samsung's main image sensor on a 1 over 1.3 inch type sensor against a good 1-inch sensor with a 50 megapixel resolution, it's really close. So if I put a 1-inch type sensor into 50 megapixel mode and I put a Samsung into 200 megapixel mode, I think the image quality is pretty close. When you zoom in to fine details, you can keep zooming on the Samsung, but the image doesn't keep getting better. After a certain level, the Samsung might be a tiny bit better for like fine details, blades of grass, stuff like that. But that could also just be accounted for the difference, the minute differences in focus. So I did a shootout between the X90 Pro and the Galaxy S23 Ultra. And I showed, here's a raw file to raw file, and now here's 200 megapixel against 50 megapixel. And I don't know, I think it's kind of a toss-up, if not maybe even a slight advantage for the larger sensor, having better image quality. The IQ of larger pixels kind of makes up for the lack of smaller and smaller and smaller subpixels, where you keep cutting one big pixel into tinier and tinier elements. In that video I show, I kept tapping on the same spot in my viewfinder, but I ended up with slightly different focus on one of my tests. And if I were a hack, I would have used the focus that was ever so slightly off from the subject of that photo, because then it would have looked softer, it would have looked blurrier. But I had four photos. I tap to refocus, take the photo, tap to refocus, take the photo. I do that four times. And I got one of the four that was like razor tack sharp on the exact part of the frame that I was tapping to focus on. So if I had wanted to make Samsung look bad, I could have used the first photo I took that was ever so slightly, just a little bit softer than the photo that I felt really nailed critical focus. I think it is far more likely that when you see these advantages, like, oh, I tapped to focus on the same part of the frame, and oh, look, the 200 megapixels are just so much sharper. I don't believe that. I think if you had really like locked in focus in the exact same setups, it's not that you put two phones side by side, right? Because even if I do this, the differences in composition, in exposure, are already making subtle changes in how each phone is handling the scene. Side by side is not very helpful because you don't ever frame side by side. That's not how you shoot. So it really matters that you shoot one in the orientation and really focusing for the subject, and you really try to make it the best composition that you can. And then you try your absolute hardest to match that composition on another device. And even this is maddening, because look at how much bigger, you know, like my Xiaomi is versus my Vivo. And then if I have it on a tripod, this completely changes the angle and the orientation and where the camera's pointing, and is it offset? Well, the power button is further up on this side, so this is a smaller phone, and that means that the angle is going to be off, and I've got to reframe for that. And if you don't make that effort, you're not showing an oranges to oranges comparison. You're showing one phone that you composed for better and the other phone that was just sort of along for the ride. So I put no stock into those side by side. Short story, incredibly long, Nick Gay. If you need a really large print, I would try to see if you could set up with a good, like, 50 megapixel mode. On a 1-inch type sensor, it gives you some extra dots to play with. On these 200 megapixel cameras, you can shoot a stacked DNG RAW, like a Smart RAW or a RAW Plus or an Expert RAW, and you can arrive at a 50 megapixel RAW photo from that has already got some image stacking and some HDR processing on it. And I think you end up with a better print. For my daughter's softball team, I got this really great shot of one of the girls just cracking the ball. And it's like, she's just finished her swing and the ball is still in frame. And I did a 3x1 print. So 3 feet by 1 foot. And it was just from the 12 megapixels original image. I didn't, like, that was enough resolution for that to look really good. You would really want a higher pixel density if you were doing large format prints like that. But an action shot where there's that little bit of motion blur, the ball is kind of streaking off, like the chain link fence out of focus in the foreground. I had plenty of resolution to make a 3 foot by 1 foot skinny long banner photo print. And I thought it looked great. So it also comes down to, like, what are you trying to accomplish? If you need billboard image clarity, then yeah, you've got to have more dots. But otherwise, you can stretch 12 megapixels pretty far before it really starts falling apart. Let me go ahead and get this out of the way. I know we're already running a little long, but I'm kind of curious, for the folks that are still sticking around here, as we're going into 2 hours, I'm really curious to see what Apple might try to announce for iPads. We have an Apple event tomorrow. I'm feeling like it's possible we're going to get another iteration of the Apple Pencil, just because of all their marketing material is showing, like, people erasing stuff, and, like, there's a hand that's holding on to a white stick with different kind of art surrounding it. And they have a lot of these kind of on the Apple website, these little teaser images, but they're interactive. These interactive little, like, art pieces that you can kind of play around with. So I'm kind of curious. Excuse me. I'm kind of curious if is this what consumers have been waiting for. iPad sales are down. We just saw that in Apple's last quarterlies. I don't think anyone's overly surprised. Tablets have become a very different market as consumer consumption devices. I don't think Apple has done a very good job of improving their mobile operating system to be a better solution for a consumer's needs as a general compute device. And I think we're long overdue having a touchscreen MacBook. Like, it's just stupid at this point that we don't have, like, a detachable MacBook. You know, you pull the screen off and dock it to a keyboard. And now, especially with the M series chips, which are so much more power efficient and they can be run fanless, like MacBook Air style, the iPad has all of this incredible hardware. But I feel iPad OS is still holding it back from being the kind of laptop replacement device that a lot of folks would be interested in. So instead of Apple elevating the iPad seems to exist as yet another intermediary consumption device. And there are only so many of those that you need to buy. If you have a MacBook and you have an iPhone and you have an iPad, what's really getting used? You've got all your apps on the iPhone and you do all your work on the MacBook. So you hand your iPad to your kids and then the kid bends it because these things are stupid fragile and ridiculously thin. And then you're like, oh, well, I guess that was the iPad. I don't feel this burning desire to replace that with something else. So I'm kind of curious if folks out there, what is it that Apple could do that would maybe ignite a little bit more interest in a slate form factor? For me, especially because I've been playing with Windows on ARM, and I've been, like, my Robo and Kala is in regular use around our house, and I've been taking it on a couple trips lately. It is just, I love having a slate tablet that has a full operating system on it. I don't mess with the mobile version of Microsoft Office, use the full version of Microsoft Office. I'm not trying to do, like, Snapseed edits on that Robo and Kala. I'm firing up, like, GIMP and Affinity and doing raw photo editing in a PC-style environment. That's what I want. That's what I want out of a, out of an iPad. You told me it's got this much RAM and it's got an Apple M series chip in it. It should be just as powerful as a MacBook Air. So why can't I do MacBook Air things on this hardware? It seems like a limitation created by Apple to force you to buy more products than you really need. If you could just get a MacBook with a touchscreen tablet style, like a Surface Pro kind of interface, you would never need an iPad, or you'd never need an iPad Pro. Let's at least divide between iPad Air, iPad, and iPad Pro. So, actually, Hassan, that would actually be cool too. A matte display on an iPad would be sick. No, I agree with you too, especially for doodling and for that kind of like portability, for sketchbooking, stuff like that. No, I'm with you there. I mean, I'm not saying there aren't ways that we can iterate and improve the iPad, but what I'm curious is like, what would get people excited to flip an older iPad for a newer one? Because I tell you, like, here's a new Apple Pencil you need to buy. Doesn't sound exciting to me, and I don't know how many people are saying that that's really going to get them to do it. JGJ, they just launched the USB-C Pencil, but they might need to make a magnetic one. The USB-C Apple Pencil is kind of pants, though, isn't it? Isn't it the one that it's like more limited, but it has the USB-C charging, and that's like the big hook? Oh, yeah, JoJo, this is hilarious to me whenever people start getting up in their feelings about stuff like this. Some are yelling from the hilltops, quote, "It's the end of laptops as we know it because the iPads are coming." And remember when they put the M1 in the iPad? How many people are out there? I was one of them. As much as I despise Apple as a corporate entity, DaVinci Resolve and an Apple M1 in an iPad had me so close to pulling the trigger on an iPad. But it was so close that really what it did instead is it made me want DaVinci Resolve on Windows on ARM. And now I'm getting much, much closer to having that be realized. I don't see anything exciting me to bring me into that iPad. But I really wanted, low power, fanless, high performance, slate computing. But Apple holds that experience back. And I do not want to have to mess with iPad OS file management. So there's no way. And especially like for the same price, you could get a really decent MacBook as an iPad Pro. This is not the end of laptops in any serious way. From Michael Corcoran, everyone is saying it's going to be OLED. Is OLED really that expensive these days? I know whenever whenever has some really cheap tablets with OLED, Samsung has it on some A-series phones. Lenovo, that's what he's saying. I know Lenovo has some really cheap tablets with OLED. So yeah, you can move parts and pieces around. OLED is still more expensive. A nice OLED is still more expensive than LCD. But like my Robo Ancala, that screen is gorgeous. And it's only 60 hertz. It is not high refresh OLED, but I kind of don't care. Even 60 hertz looks really good throughout the Windows UI. Animations are fluid. It's powerful enough to keep up with the multitasking experience, and I get the full version of Windows programs. And that's a tablet that, when it was new, was kind of selling in the ballpark of a Galaxy Tab. A Galaxy Tab S. You know, a more expensive Galaxy Tab. OLED is not that expensive to get a nice OLED screen. But of course, Apple will make anything sound like it really costs a premium. Oh, Tobias, that would be cool. I want to see an Xperia tablet once again. Man, do I miss Xperia tablets. I still remember the Z tablet series. That would be sweet. And again, like I said, Sony walked away from a market where, just imagine a photo professional content creation tablet. Like Sony's tools and apps and services, the ability to plug directly into your camera and use that as a monitor and a recording interface or a broadcast interface. And then you could do like multiples. You could like have a Sony tablet with three ports. You could do a triple camera setup and use just this tablet as like a control interface. I just feel like Sony has left so much money on the table, not tying their products together like that. Yeah, Barry, I would think, so Barry says, I would think people are just buying iPads when they need to get a new one. And I don't see anything that motivates, this is a feature or this is performance that I need in this iPad more. It's, well, my old iPad is old and they're saying that I can't really fix it and it's going to be expensive. You know what? I might as well just get a new one. That seems to be where we're at with tablets, iPads specifically. So I don't know. I'm just really trying to think, like, iPad OS holds this back so much. So I don't know. Michael Corcoran says, I don't use tablets for media consumption much because I usually already have a phone on me and they're big enough. I tend to use them more for productivity on the desk and landscape. And to me, that's one of those things where if I'm already looking at second screen solutions and what is it that I'm trying to accomplish? And if I don't need the tablet for its own compute power, then why not go to a portable monitor or some kind of wearable display or something like that? So I'm definitely feeling you there. To me, it's why am I replicating additional compute power when I'm not going to use that compute power in an expensive product? And again, I don't see where people get excited about a new iPad there. I feel like there's probably a built-up demand for a new iPad from people that have been using older iPads. So I do believe that when as we get into the end of 2024, we will see a significant uptick in iPad sales. But that's not because new features or services or software have really empowered the user to do more with their iPads. I think it's more people have been waiting to see a refresh. And we've kind of gone outside of that normal cycle of hardware refreshing. And so now you've got people that are waiting it out a little bit longer to get something that feels a little newer. That to me seems to be the fundamental difference between like people excited for new features on an iPad versus people that just have older iPads lying around and they want to get something new. Yeah, Barry Johnson, add Mac OS. It's dumb that we don't have a Surface Pro version of a Mac OS computer. It's dumb. It is real dumb. Yeah, John Gao. Sorry, Juan, but I'll definitely buy a Mac OS powered Apple Silicon iPad Pro. I don't think that's... people are acting like, oh man, gotcha there, Juan. No, what did I just say? If I could have made an iPad with DaVinci Resolve work, that's what I would have gone to. I couldn't make it work, but that's really what I want. It drives me crazy that actually doesn't exist and that Apple has been so incapable of adding good touch support to their own products. Like, you can make fun of Microsoft through the Windows 8 to Windows 10 to Windows 11 transitions, but let me tell you, Windows 11 with touch controls and gestures and dock windows and floating spaces, you pick up a tablet experience of Windows, it is so much better than it used to be. It is really, really nice, and it's so much more familiar than trying to do more advanced multitasking stuff in Android, because we've had to shoehorn multitasking into Android. Windows was already a capable multitasking desktop or laptop style operating system, and we just had to kind of polish up the touch gestures. Apple has not been able to do that. For all of the praise that Apple gets on improving the consumer experience and polishing the experience and, oh, they're never first, but they get there the best and it just works, they can't do it. They refuse to do it. So again, like when Barry's saying, like, add Mac OS to the iPad, to me, that's a no-brainer. But then they would have to go through that process that Microsoft has spent years refining. We're putting it out there. We're saying touch is ready on the Mac. But it's kind of not really ready. So we just turned our customers into beta testers. Let me get this out of the way here. From Command MX, For me, a tablet PC is also something where I want to be able to work in an IT guy style, not in a meeting guy style. Will you create a review of the latest Minis Forum V3? It looks so interesting and exactly the thing where an iPad should develop into. I am trying to get my hands on that V3. I really don't want to buy it right before all of the X Elite laptops come out, but it looks real good. The only thing that does kind of irk me a bit is for all of the incredible improvements that AMD, more so than Intel, AMD has really shown a knack for improving the performance per watt on x86 processors. Like the 7000 series AMD chips are a lot better than I've really been giving them credit for. They're still not as good as ARM chips. Like, when I don't do stuff on my Robo Ancala, the power draw drops to like 2 watts. I mean, it is like a tenth the power sort of draw of like an x86 processor. So it's still that little thing, like if I'm maximizing the performance potential of the Minis Forum V3, it is actually surprisingly capable. It still needs cooling, but you're getting a much better performance per watt. But in just a more casual use and the things that kind of keep your battery running longer out in the field, it's still x86. I don't know. I'm really not trying to slag it off, but like I want to play with one just to see like how does this really work. I got all these amazing battery life estimates on the Surface Book, the Surface Laptop Go 2. Which has a little U-series Core i5. I have the Core i5 model. And you're like, okay, well, if you do a little bit of browsing and a little bit of streaming audio and a little bit of emailing and like a little bit of video watching, you can get like 20 hours of battery life if the screen's at like minimal brightness. It's like you have to see all of those asterisks, but then I just crank my Robo Ancala, which has a smaller battery than my Laptop Go 2, and it just gets phenomenally better battery life. I don't have to jump through hoops. I'm not constantly managing the brightness. It's just better. And that's the thing that I really wish I've seen a little bit more. Like Notebook Check, I think, did a really good write-up on the Minis Forum. But that lifestyle power usage still seems to be a knock against more traditional laptop-style chips. JGJ, I mean, that is absolutely a fair consideration. OLED burn-in issues, though. I never understood the appeal long-term. I haven't had it that long, but I've been using the Robo Ancala pretty heavy. I think I've been changing up the wallpaper and the orientation moves around, and you can do things like you can drop the dock so it hides the dock out of the way so you don't have like persistent burn in on dock images. And I don't know. I feel like over the lifestyle of a product, and from what we've seen on all the phones, that some handle burn in better than others. I don't know. I don't know that I'm as concerned about OLED long term for mobile devices like that. I feel like, I mean, other issues notwithstanding, like we can talk about, you know, weird tint issues and low light and power width modulation, pulsing and green lines on Samsung displays. Like every OLED seems to have its own generational issue, whatever that might be. But the burn-in thing, I just haven't experienced it in any serious way on any of my other OLED products. So like that one to me has been less an issue, but again, I'm also getting to cycle these things a bit more frequently than your average consumers who might stick with one product for like 8 years. But at 8 years, I feel like you're also getting to a point where it's like there have been other issues and other concerns and battery degradation and performance optimizations and everything else too. You might also just want to be looking at another device also. So I don't know. If anyone else wants to speak up on long-term use of like an OLED tablet, my current OLED experiences have been pretty good, like all the way back to some of my older like Galaxy S3 era phones and stuff. So I don't know. I can't comment much more than that. Yeah, Ali, I got an LG G8 almost 5 years old. It only has a slight hint of burn-in at the bottom for back, home, and recent buttons. Again, for things that are persistent and never move. But with the G8, that was also the generation where I earnestly moved over to swipe controls. So gesture navigation kind of helps you get away from having some of those issues too. Michael Corcoran saying, maybe I'm just lucky, but I've never noticed burn-in on any of my OLED phones, even with my Note 9 and Pixel 3, which are pretty ancient, but I'm still dealing with a sample size of, like, less than 10 devices. I have a sample size of more than 10 devices. again, I get to at least move through them in different ways than people live with their phones. I'm not using one phone for 4 years, every day, all day. So there can be issues. I'm not trying to dismiss burn-in, but I also feel like it's a problem to put in a particular context or an issue to put into a specific perspective. Let's see. Oh, Al Sabakli, reading comics on my Surface Pro 8 is pretty awesome. Tried it on a phone, but it's a massive pain. Yeah, I mean, again, like, a tablet as a media consumption device is pretty interesting. And it can be fun, but that's also where, like, I don't need an Apple M Series chip to watch videos, let my daughter play some of her casual games, and read comics. So what does an iPad do in that's really going to move the needle on the consumer experience? Oh yeah, Nick, I'm making a choice, and I don't know that everyone needs to follow my choice. Nick says, dude, that's where I'm stuck. I want a new tablet, but I also don't know if I want an X Elite device versus an Intel laptop. I am putting my budget for review devices on Qualcomm X Elite laptops. I'm buying fewer phones. I'm not trying to review every phone that comes out this year. I'm not trying to piggyback a bunch of tablets. I really don't spend a lot of time with tablets in general, but like years past, like Pixel tablet, some foldable phones, the OnePlus pad, I got to spend some time with the loaner, stuff like that. I have the Robo and Kala, and I really want that experience, but with more horsepower. That's it. So if X Elite really can deliver the goods, then for me, that discussion's done. As soon as I can get a Robo and Kala style device, but with a Snapdragon X Elite, good. Let me fire up DaVinci Resolve on that, and I need to edit on the go. Oh, baby, that should be real nice. I'm really looking forward to that. So, let me get this out of the way here. Yeah, John Gow. I mean, that's kind of what I'm saying here. Since Mac OS on iPad is not happening, I'll probably go for the X Elite Surface Pro. So that's another one. I really want to see what Microsoft does. I want the more powerful version of an X Elite. So I'll probably end up with a more traditional laptop. But I am keeping a close eye on Surface Pro. I think it's going to be the most expensive version of that idea. But I have to believe Lenovo is going to be attacking that market. I'm hoping Robo and Kala, like, that they come back with a refresh. If they can just kind of keep the same frame as their tablet and put in an X Elite Plus, that would be exciting too. So I think it's about time we could wrap all this stuff up. One more from Michael Corcoran here. It's a tough decision. Fanless experience, great battery life versus much more compatibility with gaming options. It's a tough decision if it's going to be your only Windows device, especially. And that's the last unknown, is how much better compatibility will the gaming conversation be when I can play Baldur's Gate and I can play Control on an X Elite chip? Like, I can play Control at the lowest possible graphic settings and still kind of keep up over 20 frames per second in action sequences. Like, on an 8CX Gen 3, that's pretty good. I have not been as concerned with the gaming compatibility conversation after getting a Steam Deck. And you can't tell me that gaming on Linux is like so much more robust and better than sort of the emulation and the support that we'll see on gaming on Windows on ARM. They're, I think, different, but I don't know that they're exclusively, like one is exclusively better than the other. But we've seen an uptick in Linux compatibility for gaming because of products like the Steam Deck. So I would imagine we'll see an uptick in gaming on ARM once more laptops are coming out with ARM chips. Like, you can't make more games compatible with X Elite before X Elite is out. You couldn't make more games compatible with a Proton-powered portable handheld gaming device until that Steam OS device was actually out in the ecosystem. Like, the first week I had my Steam Deck, there were a lot of games that weren't compatible with it, and now there are a lot of games that are compatible with the Steam Deck. So, let's go ahead and put a pin in this. I gotta wrap this up. I'm running a little long, even on top of starting the show with another audio goof. Folks, thanks for sticking in there. Thanks for hanging in there, sticking with me. Good audio gremlin always manages to throw me off my game and suck a lot of the fun out of trying to do a weekly podcast. But I appreciate folks who were giving me the good feedback on how to appropriately handle some of the issues with that audio broadcasting. It does help. It really does kind of sort of, and again, showcase, like, I don't know what you're hearing. So if there's an issue, I don't hear it. Everything on my side was great until I was able to kind of catch those dropouts. So, lots of stuff still in the pipeline. I have no idea when some of the content is really going to publish, but increasingly it's probably going to go more and more towards discussion and conversation on Patreon and on the private Discord, and then following that up with like the last part of the publishing going to the public YouTube and then to somegadgetguide.com. If you have any thoughts on like what the strategy should look like, or if I should make a public announcement saying, hey, from now on, I'm only going to be answering questions on the Patreon, or if you want to reach out to me on somegadgetguide.com, we can do comments there. I'd really love some feedback. Just see what people's thoughts are and what makes sense for this community. And also like how to handle this in an era of tech burnout and mental health content creator issues. So let's have that chat. I think it's a chat worth having. I want everybody to catch all of the other fun channels that are putting out stuff this week. I saw, we had Sam in here from Nomad Tech. We've got Barry. We've got so many people that were jumping in. JoJo, some fun conversation. Be on the lookout for streams and videos and content, because that's all the perspective that you should really be following. Like, They're living with these products. They're putting their own money on these products. And it's the more valuable tech conversation than a lot of these mega channels that seem to like kind of suck up all the attention. They don't deserve it. Your friends in this chat deserve more of your attention. So we'll jump back in next week. We'll have some fun to talk about. We'll follow up this Apple iPad announcement. We'll probably get just like another glimmer of leaks from the Sony Xperia. And I'll have a little bit more to say about some things that I'm currently under embargo on. So there will be at least one thing I can say for certain will publish this week that should be interesting. It should be fun to talk about. In the meantime, I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe, take care, and take care of yourself so you can keep taking care of others. I'll catch you back. I love you all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.